Universe of Stone. People will not die for business, but only for ideals. Adolf Hitler and Mein Kampf. Saint Germain and Jesus were not the only messiahs to appear in the 1930s bearing promises of an imminent utopia. Another messiah was gaining a large following in Germany. His coming was said to be the beginning of the millennium. Using one of the Brotherhood's most important symbols, the swastika, that German messiah's name was Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler, of course, was the strutting man with the toothbrush mustache who became absolute dictator of Germany and instigated World War II. Hitler and his entourage would look comical to us today, were not the consequences of their lunacy so tragic. During his young adulthood before rising to power, Hitler lived in Vienna. One of Hitler's friends during that period was Walter Johannes Stein. During World War II, Dr. Stein became an advisor to England's Prime Minister, Sir Winston Churchill. Much of what Dr. Stein had to say about Hitler's early life found its way into a book entitled Spear of Destiny by Trevor Ravenscroft. Spear of Destiny reports that Hitler had become a devotee of mysticism during his poverty-stricken days in Vienna. Between 1909 and 1913, when Hitler was in his early 20s, Hitler was convinced that he had achieved higher levels of consciousness by means of drugs. Hitler made a penetrating study of medieval occultism and ritual magic, discussing with him, Stein, the whole span of the political, historical, and philosophical reading through which he formulated what was later to become the Nazi Weltanschauung, a special concept of human history. In his autobiography, Mein Kampf, Hitler affirmed the importance of this period in shaping his ideas. Hitler did not develop his ideology in a vacuum. One of his most influential mentors was a Viennese bookstore owner named Ernst Prech. Prech was described by Dr. Stein as a malevolent-looking man with a somewhat toad-like appearance. Prech was a devotee of the Germanic mysticism that was preaching the coming of an Aryan superrace. Hitler frequented Prech's store and pawned books there when he needed money. During those visits, Prech indoctrinated Hitler in Germanic mysticism and successfully encouraged Hitler to use the hallucinogenic drug peyote as a tool for achieving mystical enlightenment. As it turns out, Prech was associated with a man named Guido von Liszt. Von Liszt was a founding member and leading figure in an occult lodge which used a swastika instead of a cross in its rituals. Before he was disgraced and forced to flee from Vienna, von Liszt had gained a large audience for his Germanic mystical writings. Hitler became a member of that audience through Prech. Back in his Viennese flophouse room, young Hitler avidly pored through pamphlets and books expounding on the mystical destiny of Germany and the coming of the Aryan superrace. According to some of those tracts, Aryans were created by an extraterrestrial superrace of giants. Hitler became an ardent believer in those ideas as he hawked his watercolors on the street to support his meager existence and to pay for his drug-induced enlightenments. The notion that Hitler was a druggie in his youth seeking mystical enlightenment through chemicals should come as no surprise. Drugs were a major factor in shaping the persona of Adolf Hitler. Hitler remained a user of powerful narcotics his entire life. According to the diaries of Hitler's personal physician, Dr. Theodor Morell, which surfaced in the U.S. National Archives, the German dictator was repeatedly injected with various painkillers, sedatives, strychnine, cocaine, a morphine derivative, and other drugs during the entire 4 years of World War II. The mystical philosophy so eagerly adopted by the young Hitler was the same one which had already deeply affected the Kaiser and other German leaders. In fact, Houston Stuart Chamberlain, the mystic who had so influenced the Kaiser, years later declared Hitler to be the prophesied German Messiah. On September 25, 1925, the Nazi newspaper, Völkischer Beobachter, celebrated Chamberlain's 70th birthday and declared his work, Foundations of the 20th Century, to be the gospel of the Nazi movement. As we recall, the Kaiser considered the same book to have been sent by God. Hitler's road to politics began as a German soldier during World War I. When that war broke out, Hitler enlisted. He remained very concerned about the mystical destiny of Germany and continued to ponder the Aryan question while fighting in the fields. This made him very unpopular with his fellow soldiers, who were more concerned with food, leave, women, and an end to the war which nearly all of them detested. Hitler, on the other hand, flourished in the war-torn environment and distinguished himself as a soldier. he won the highest award a soldier of his rank, corporal, could earn, the Iron Cross, first class. About 2 months after winning the Iron Cross, Hitler was blinded by mustard gas during a battle. He was taken to the Pazewalk Military Hospital in northern Germany, where he was mistakenly diagnosed as suffering from psychopathic hysteria. The symptoms were probably caused by the mustard gas. Hitler was consequently placed under the care of a psychiatrist, Dr. Edmund Forster. What exactly was done to Hitler while under Dr. Forster's care is uncertain, because years later, in 1933, Hitler's secret police, the Gestapo, rounded up all psychiatric records related to Hitler's treatment and destroyed them. Dr. Forster committed suicide in that same year. The mystery of what was done to Hitler at Pazewalk is deepened by Hitler's own statements. According to Hitler, he had experienced a vision from another world while at the hospital. In that vision, Hitler was told that he would need to restore his sight so that he could lead Germany back to glory. Hitler's latent anti-Semitism, which had already been planted by his mystical readings in Vienna, emerged at Pazewalk. What had happened at that hospital? In a shrewd piece of detective work published in the journal History of Childhood Quarterly, psychohistorian Dr. Rudolf Binion suggests that Hitler's visions may have been deliberately induced by the psychiatrist, Edmund Forster, as a means of helping Hitler recover from his blindness. Hitler's mystical beliefs were well known, and they would certainly have come out in his psychiatric interviews. Dr. Binion cites a book completed in 1939 entitled Der Augenzeuge, The Eyewitness, written by a Jewish doctor named Ernst Weiss, who had fled Germany in 1933. In Der Augenzeuge, the author tells a thinly fictionalized story of a man, H., who was taken to Pazewalk Hospital for psychiatric care. H. claims that he had been hit by mustard gas. At Pazewalk, the psychiatrist in charge deliberately induces visionary ideas into the mind of the hysterical H. in order to effect a cure. The miracle cure is successful, and years later, in the summer of 1933, the psychiatrist attempts to send the records of the treatments abroad to keep them out of the hands of the Gestapo. In his article, Dr. Binion points out that Hitler's psychiatrist, Edmund Forster, had been abroad in Paris that summer, and it is Dr. Binion's guess that Forster may have revealed the facts of Hitler's treatment to someone at that time, resulting in the book, Der Augenzeuge. Forster may have also been the person who revealed that two other very high-ranking Nazis, Bernhard Rust, Prussian Minister of Education, and Hermann Göring, both had histories of severe mental problems. Rust was a certified psychopath and Göring was a former morphine addict. After Hitler's discharge from Pazewalk in November of 1918, he traveled back to Munich. He remained in the army and, in April of 1919, he was assigned to espionage duties. A communist revolution had just occurred in southern Germany, and a Soviet republic had been declared there after the regional government collapsed. Hitler was one of the soldier spies selected to remain behind in Munich and circulate among the pro-communist soldiers to learn the identities of their leaders. When a German Reichswehr force from Berlin moved in and crushed the rebellion, Hitler walked down the ranks of captured soldiers and singled out the ringleaders. The German soldiers who were identified by Hitler were taken away for immediate execution without trial. Hitler watched as many of his victims were put before the wall and shot. Hitler's stellar performance in Munich earned him a promotion. He was assigned to the highly secret political department of the Army District Command. Hitler's new unit was an intelligence operation that engaged in acts of domestic terrorism. The unit refused to accept Germany's defeat in World War I, and so it assassinated some of the German leaders who had negotiated Germany's surrender. A prominent leader of the District Command was Captain Ernst Röhm. Röhm was a professional soldier who served as liaison between the District Command and the German industrialists who were directly funding the District Command to help it fight communism. Captain Röhm and many other members of the District Command were members of a mystical organization known as the Thule Society. The Thule believed in the Aryan superrace, and it preached the coming of a German Messiah who would lead Germany to glory and a new Aryan civilization. In Spear of Destiny, we learn from Dr. Stein that the Thule group was financed by some of the very same industrialists who supported the District Command. The Thule was also directly supported by the German High Command. Many assassinations perpetrated by the District Command may have been inspired by the Thule. According to Dr. Stein, the Thule was a society of assassins. It held secret courts and condemned people to death. It is likely that many victims murdered by the district command had been condemned earlier in the secret courts of the Thule. Many prominent Germans supported this violence and were documented members of the Thule. For example, the police president of Munich, Franz Gärtner, was a reported member of the innermost circle of the Thule. He later became Minister of Justice of the Third Reich. After joining the district command, Corporal Adolf Hitler became a good friend of Ernst Röhm. It was Röhm who took Hitler to see Dietrich Eckart, a morphine addict who headed the German Thule Society. Röhm had a purpose for arranging this meeting. He felt that Hitler had strong leadership potential and that Hitler was the man the Thule was looking for. Eckart agreed, and Hitler's career as the new German Messiah was launched. The vehicle used by Hitler to gain political power was a small socialist organization known as the German Workers' Party. In September 1919, Hitler was sent by the district command to attend a meeting of the party. Hitler was subsequently invited by the party to join it, and within a year he became the party's leader. At a 1920 party rally held in a Munich beer hall, Hitler announced that the German Workers' Party was to be renamed the Nationalsozialistische Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, or Nazi Party for short. In Mein Kampf, Hitler stated that he had made an agonizing decision to quit the district command in order to participate in the German Workers' Party. Many historians strongly doubt that Hitler had left the district command and believe instead that the German Workers' Party was the vehicle used by the district command to covertly further its political aims. There is good evidence to support this conclusion. Ernst Röhm, Hitler's mentor in the district command, had already joined and started shaping the German Workers' Party before Hitler became a member. Röhm greatly assisted Hitler in transforming the German Workers' Party into Hitler's political tool. Röhm grew with the fledgling Nazi Party and later became the leader of the Nazi SA organization, better known as the Brown Shirts. Note: Röhm eventually lost his political power when the SA was reduced and Himmler's SS organization rose to supremacy. Röhm's usefulness to the Thule Society and to the German intelligence apparat was outlived by 1934 when Nazi officers went to Röhm's home to arrest him for allegedly conspiring to overthrow his former underling, Hitler. Röhm was reportedly found in his bedroom in a compromising position with one of his top aides. He was offered a chance to commit suicide, but he refused, so the Nazis shot him in a Munich prison. It is interesting that Röhm did not suspect the fate which awaited him because Hitler had personally traveled to Munich to meet and escort him. Hitler was a master at using other people's trust to betray them in extraordinarily treacherous ways. It was one of the methods used to send Jews and other undesirables to their deaths in Nazi slave labor camps. Thule leader Dietrich Eckart, who was also closely affiliated with district command leaders, became the editor-in-chief of the new Nazi newspaper, Völkischer Beobachter. Hitler had by no means abandoned his district command friends. They were all in there turning the German Workers' Party into the Nazi Party. Although the Thule was probably the most important mystical organization behind the formation of Nazism, it was not the only one. Another was the Vril Society, which had been named after a book by Lord Bulwer Lytton, an English Rosicrucian. Lytton's book told the story of an Aryan super-race coming to Earth. One member of the German Vril was Professor Karl Haushofer, a former employee of German military intelligence. Haushofer had been a mentor to Hitler as well as to Hitler's propaganda specialist, Rudolf Hess. Hess had been an assistant to Haushofer at the University of Munich. Another Vril member was the second most powerful man in Nazi Germany, Heinrich Himmler, who became head of the dreaded SS and Gestapo. Himmler incorporated the Vril Society into the Nazi occult bureau. Yet another mystical group was the Edelweiss Society, which preached the coming of a Nordic Messiah. Nazi financial dictator Hermann Göring had become an active member of the Edelweiss Society in 1921 while living and working in Sweden. Göring believed Hitler to be the Nordic Messiah. Nazism was clearly more than a political movement. It was a powerful new brotherhood faction steeped in brotherhood beliefs and symbols. The emblem chosen to represent the Nazi Party was the swastika, an important brotherhood symbol since antiquity. Hitler was proclaimed not only a political messiah, but also a religious messiah whose coming signaled the fulfillment of the apocalyptic philosophies espoused by German mystical groups. Hitler's coming was to bring about the thousand-year Reich, a millennium in which mankind would be purified and reach its highest state of existence. Nazism was a custodial religious philosophy as much as it was a political ideology. In a speech he gave at the Nazis' 1934 Nuremberg rally, Hitler said about the party, "Its total image, however, will be like a holy order." Note: Nazis were not the only people involved in World War II for whom mysticism was important. Many top military leaders of Japan, which was allied to Germany, were members of a secret mystical society known for its black dragon symbol. In the United States, President Franklin D. Roosevelt, a staunch anti-Nazi, was a Freemason, as was his successor, Harry S. Truman, who ordered the dropping of atomic bombs on two Japanese cities, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, near the end of the war. The brutal Nazi Party as a holy order? The idea seems laughable in hindsight, until we note that this would not be the first time in history that a holy order was responsible for massive atrocities. The Dominicans who ran the Catholic Inquisition during the Middle Ages were another example. World War II lasted from 1939 until 1945. It took a terrible toll on human life. Much of that toll was the result of the Nazis' most horrific accomplishment, a massive German concentration camp system in which 11 million people died. 6 million of the victims were Jews. By that time in history, concentration camps had become quite the fashion, a beginning with the British in Africa, a continuing with the Bolsheviks in Russia, and the American internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, and sinking to their lowest levels of barbarity in Nazi Germany. Most people know the Nazi concentration camps for their gas chambers, grisly human experiments, and the deliberate starvation of inmates. The camps were a part of the Nazis' so-called final solution. The final solution was not just an attempt to racially purify the human race by physically exterminating all Jews and other undesirables. It was an effort to kill them in accordance with a grand economic plan. As in Russia, the Nazi concentration camps were designed to be a vital part of the national economy. More than 300 camps were constructed in Germany alone. Many of them were located near large factories specially designed to be ran on the slave labor provided by the camps. The infamous Auschwitz camp, for example, was constructed next to an enormous industrial plant for processing and refining oil and rubber. The intent of the final solution was to destroy non-Aryans, which the Nazis thought of as human mutations, by reducing them to the lowest common denominator. Camp inmates became expendable economic units forced to work to their maximum limit while slowly starving to death. After death, the physical components of their bodies were often used for other purposes. Gold tooth fillings were extracted and sent to the German treasury. Human hair was sometimes woven into blankets. Even human skin was fashioned into lampshades and other decorative items. The Nazi concentration camp system reduced human beings quite literally to the level of livestock. Most of the concentration camp factories were operated by the giant German chemical combine, IG Farben. In fact, one of Farben's subsidiaries manufactured the poison gas used in concentration camp gas chambers. A remarkable book, The Crime and Punishment of IG Farben, by Joseph Borkin, documents how the Farben companies, in cooperation with the Nazi SS, ran the concentration camps and adjacent factories as a business enterprise. Mr. Borkin's book reproduces a settlement of accounts made between IG Farben and the SS for the work of concentration camp inmates. The receipt is neatly handwritten with slave labor rates priced in a very businesslike fashion. Those admitted into the SS were therefore only to be of the purest Aryan, also taught, with a special emphasis on the occult meanings of the swastika. Himmler dreamed that the SS would build the foundation of the new Aryan utopia. When the war ended, all 24 top executives of IG Farben were the German subsidiaries of IET and General Electric. As had been true earlier of the district command, this direct funding enabled the SS to act outside the purse strings of the larger national party. It also permitted the industrialists to have a more direct influence into SS activities. Nazism and all of its atrocities could never have happened without the support of the German banking fraternity. Banking, industry, and government were as tightly interwoven in Nazi Germany as they are in nearly every nation today. In Germany, many bankers held management positions in other companies, not the least of which was IG Farben. For example, Max and Paul Warburg, who ran major banks in Germany and the United States, and who, incidentally, had been instrumental in establishing the Federal Reserve System in the United States, were IG G. Farben Directors. H. A. Metz of IA. G. Farben was a director of the Bank of Manhattan, which was a Warburg Bank in the United States that later became part of the Chase Manhattan Bank managed by the Rockefeller family. Note: another Rockefeller company, Standard Oil of New Jersey, had been a cartel partner with I.G. Farben prior to the war. One director of American I.G. Farben was C. E. Mitchell, who was also director of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and of National City Bank. Most significantly, Hermann Schmitz, president of I.G. Farben in Germany, had served on the boards of the Deutsche Bank and the Bank for International Settlements. As we recall, the Bank for International Settlements was the apex of the international central banking community and the interlocking inflatable paper money systems. Schmitz was one of the few I.G. Farben executives sentenced to a prison term at Nuremberg. He received a 10-year sentence. Perhaps the most surprising support for Hitler in the international banking fraternity came from the director of the Bank of England, Montagu Norman. England, of course, was an enemy of Nazi Germany during World War II. According to Dr. Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, Mr. Norman was the commander-in-chief of the world system of banking control during his governorship of the Bank of England from 1920 until 1944. Said Dr. Quigley, many wealthy and influential persons like Montagu Norman and Henri de Turing, owner of Shell Oil, directed public attention to the danger of Bolshevism while maintaining a neutral, or favorable, attitude toward Nazism. Montagu Norman apparently felt more than mere neutrality towards Nazism, however. According to a Chicago newspaper story, dated November 3, 1938, in the spring of 1934, a select group of city financiers gathered around Montagu Norman in the windowless building of the Bank of England in Threadneedle Street. Among those present were Sir Alan Anderson, partner in Anderson, Green & Company, Lord, then Sir Josiah Stamp, chairman of the LMS railway system, Edward Shaw, chairman of the P&O steamship lines, Sir Robert Kindersley, a partner in Hambros Brothers, C. T. Tyarks, head of J. Schroeder Co. But now a new power was established on Europe's political horizon, namely, Nazi Germany. Hitler had disappointed his critics. His regime was no temporary nightmare, but a system with a good future, and Mr. Norman advised his directors to include Hitler in their plans. There was no opposition, and it was decided that Hitler should get covert help from London's financial section until Mr. Norman had succeeded in putting sufficient pressure on the government to make it abandon its pro-French policy for a more promising pro-German orientation. The Bank of England continued to support Hitler even after the Nazi dictator embarked on his program of conquest. After Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia in violation of the non-aggression pact between then Prime Minister Chamberlain of England and Hitler, the Bank of England gave Nazi Germany £6 million of Czech gold reserves held by the bank. In the same way that a small clique of German petty princes had made a fortune from war in the 18th century by renting soldiers to warring nations, a small clique of banks and multinational corporations made a large profit by providing goods and services to both sides fighting in World War II. After giving early support to Hitler, the Bank of England naturally provided loans to Britain to fight Hitler. At the same time that the German subsidiaries of IET and General Electric were giving money to the SS and providing needed services to Nazi Germany, other branches in America and elsewhere were aiding Germany's enemies. As I.G. Farben fueled Hitler's war machine in Germany, one of its old cartel partners, Standard Oil, fueled the Allied effort against Germany. While the Ford Motor Company produced materials for the American Army to fight Germany, Ford plants in Germany were turning out military vehicles for the Nazis. No matter who won the war, those banks and companies would profit and find favor with whoever emerged victorious. The overwhelming role that various bankers and industrialists played in propping up Hitler and in building the Nazi war machine has caused some historians to view those bankers and industrialists as the true powers behind Nazism. They were indeed highly significant, but were they actually the ultimate sources that gave us Nazism? As we have already noted, Nazism arose out of the mystical Brotherhood network. Some researchers have erroneously concluded that radical brotherhood organizations have been the tools of political, military, and economic leaders, rather than vice versa. This mistake is usually made because few historians have dared consider that the Brotherhood network has been senior in power and influence to human elites. Once that influence is acknowledged, one must then ask, who is the power behind the Brotherhood? We have, of course, already answered that question in a manner unacceptable to a great many people, members of an extraterrestrial race, i.e., the Custodial Society. Once we begin to take such an extraordinary possibility seriously, we must return our gaze to the pages of history for confirmation, in this case to Nazi Germany. When we do so, we discover something quite remarkable. The Nazis themselves claimed that an extraterrestrial society was the source of their ideology and the power behind their organization. Throughout history, Brotherhood organizations have been pledging ultimate loyalty to assorted gods, angels, cosmic beings, ascended masters from other planets, and similar non-terrestrials, nearly all of which appear to be custodians disguised by veils of myth. The Thule Society and Nazi mysticism itself also claimed that its true leadership came from extraterrestrial sources. The Nazis referred to their hidden extraterrestrial masters as underground supermen. Hitler believed in the supermen and claimed that he had once met one of them, as did other members of the Thule leadership. The Nazis said that their supermen lived beneath the Earth's surface and were the creators of the Aryan race. Aryans therefore constituted the world's only pure race, and all other people were viewed as genetic mutations. The Nazis planned to repurify humanity by murdering everyone who was not an Aryan. Top Nazi leaders believed that the underground supermen would return to the surface of the Earth to rule it as soon as the Nazis began their racial purification program and established the Thousand-Year Reich. These Nazi beliefs are very similar to other custodial religions which teach people to prepare for the future return of supernatural or superhuman beings who will reign over a utopian Earth. As in other custodial religions, the coming of the Nazi supermen would coincide with a great final divine judgment. Of the divine judgment, Hitler had declared in court during his early Nazi days, "The Nazi army we have formed is growing from day to day. I nourish the proud hope that one day the hour will come when these rough companies will grow into battalions, the battalions to regiments, the regiments to divisions, that the old cockade, ribbon or rosette worn on a hat as a badge, will be taken from the mud, that the old flags will wave again, that there will be a reconciliation at the last great divine judgment which we are prepared to face." It would seem that the Nazi supermen were not extraterrestrials at all, but were earthly in origin because they allegedly hailed from beneath our planet's surface. However, Hitler and his mystical compatriots had a curiously inverted view of the universe. To their way of thinking, the universe consists of infinite rock which is broken by numerous hollow areas. In other words, the universe is like an infinite piece of Swiss cheese, solid with many holes in it. The concave surfaces of the hollow areas are the surfaces of planets, including Earth. Humans are therefore not living on the outer surface of a round ball. They are being pushed by gravity against the inner surface of a hollow area. According to the Nazis, the sun hangs suspended in the middle of the hollow area, the sky is made of blue gas, and the stars are tiny objects, perhaps ice crystals, which hang suspended in a similar fashion to the sun. In this infinite Swiss cheese universe of stone, there are many fissures and cracks that allow travel between the hollow areas. In an adjoining hollow area, according to Nazism, lives the race of Aryan supermen. Hitler's underground supermen were therefore true extraterrestrials, but in a curiously inverted fashion. Lest it be assumed that the Nazi Swiss cheese model of the universe was one of Hitler's big lies, there is evidence that the Nazi leadership took the idea quite seriously. For example, an attempt was made to locate the British fleet during World War II with infrared rays pointing toward the sky. The Nazis believed that the rays would hit the opposite side of the concave Earth. If for no other reason, we can be glad the Nazis lost the war so that we were spared their astronomy lessons. It is unfortunate that the Nazi defeat and reported deaths of Adolf Hitler and Heinrich Himmler did not end Nazi influence in the world. After World War II, Nazis participated in many important spheres of activity. The American Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, accepted the offer of Reinhard Gehlen, chief of Russian intelligence operations in the Nazi Secret Service, to help build the American intelligence network in Europe after the war. Gehlen's organization was staffed by many former SS members. The Gehlen organization became a significant element of the CIA in Western Europe, and it also provided the foundation for the intelligence apparat of modern West Germany. The CIA also extracted information about Nazi psychiatric techniques from Nuremberg war crime trial records for use in the CIA's infamous mind control experiments decades later. Interpol, the private international police organization which is supposed to combat international criminals and drug traffickers, was headed by former Nazi SS officers several times up until 1972. This is not surprising when we consider that Interpol was controlled by the Nazis during World War II. Prince Bernhard of the House of Orange in the Netherlands had been a member of the SS before the war, followed by a stint as an employee of IAG Farben. He then married into the House of Orange and assumed his position as chairman of Shell Oil. Prince Bernhard founded the International Bilderberg Meetings, which are still held every year. The Bilderberg Meetings are meant to be informal get-togethers of the world's top bankers, industrialists, political figures, and other prominent people for the purpose of discussing world conditions and reaching an occasional informal consensus. Prince Bernhard personally chaired these meetings until 1976, when a corruption scandal forced him to resign. To younger people today, World War II is an episode from the distant past, much as World War I is ancient history to people in their 30s and 40s. The conflict most young people understand now is the former Cold War between the United States and Soviet Union. World War II did much to set the stage for that confrontation. During World War II, Russia was an ally of the United States, Great Britain, and France in the war against Nazi Germany. Russian troops fought against the Germans in many of the Balkan nations which bordered Russia. In the ensuing instability, communist movements gained considerable power in those Balkan countries, and Russian troops remained there after the Germans were defeated. The Allies were not about to prolong the war by turning against the Soviet Union, and so the communist Eastern Bloc was born. The Nazi experience is an extraordinarily important one because it happened within the lifetime of a great many people living today. Incredibly, Nazi groups have been revived in America, Germany, and other nations. It is hard to imagine that anyone would join a movement of such proven madness, yet it is happening. The German Nazi experience revealed to us that the world is still being pushed into war, ignorance, and repeated genocides in the same manner that it has been for thousands of years, by a mystical network with organizations pledging ultimate loyalty to an extraterrestrial race. The Nazi experience revealed again a key channel through which Brotherhood Network influence has been exerted, namely, through a community of national intelligence organizations whose activities are kept secret by law and whose activities are often outside of the law. Nazism was but another brutal faction set up in opposition to so many other factions which arose out of the Brotherhood Network. This helped guarantee more war, more suffering, and the continued imprisonment of mankind on a small planet behind walls of ignorance. In Nazism, we saw all of the elements we have looked at in this book come together. The Brotherhood Network, apocalypticism, or a paper money banking elite, a genocide, or an extraterrestrial race worshipped as gods and owners of Earth. Nazism should have happened 2,000 years ago, but it occurred only decades ago. All of the history we have looked at in this book may still be happening today. These closing observations require us to look once again at the UFO phenomenon itself. If we hypothesize that human society is still being manipulated by a custodial society in the same manner that it was thousands of years ago, then we must determine that UFOs continue to behave now as they did in the distant past. Two questions we might pose to make this determination are: are UFOs still spreading the same corrupted brotherhood mysticisms today as they did earlier in history? Are they still implanting the false idea that they are God? If we are to believe the testimony of recent UFO abductees, the answer to both queries is yes.